Order. Today is Thursday, April the 5th, and I should say indeed a glorious day. The work of Senator Gordley and Senator Representative Chip Shields has just been truly amazing, and I'm sure I speak for Senator Winters when I say we were delighted to be a part and feel honored that you invited us to be a part of that, Senator Gordley. And to our constituencies sitting in the audience with us today, today was the memorializing and celebration of a bill that Senator Mark Hatfield, can you remember the bill number, Senator?
I don't recall the number, the public Oregon Public Accommodations Act,
right. 1953, okay. And so the members from our community are here today, and I'm really, really glad to see you here and hope that you will find something interesting from today's activity. What we are talking about now is the state's largest insurance company, which is the Department of Human Services Health Services Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And so I think that all Oregonians, especially those who are within the federal poverty guidelines of needing help from this agency, can take stock in the fact that this committee asks hard questions, and the interim director, bless his heart, who's been in this position for just a short length of time, having to answer some of these hard questions, but has certainly risen to the occasion, and I appreciate that very, very much. So what I'd like to do is to have Mr. Britton to outline our agenda for today, and it's in keeping members with what we have said last week in terms of getting clarifications to you in terms of the co-chair's budget. And so this will be today a lead-in into that process. Mr. Britton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I want to point out today that we have a lot of ground to cover and not much time to do it for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. The focus of their presentation today is going to be on the caseloads that comprise the Oregon Health Plan. They're going to be talking about the policy option packages that are in the governor's budget, as well as some of the reductions to the health plan that are in the governor's budget. At 2 o'clock, we would like to have the department review Health Services Divisional Addenda, and this is a part in the back of each of the books that relates to health services. Mr. Swanson, who is the budget director for the department, is going to be handing out materials for that, so you won't need to search through the book for that, but it is an opportunity to kind of get the lay of the land as far as how the budget was developed, what are some of the issues in the governor's budget. Unfortunately, it will be very short. We'll have about 10 minutes for each division to kind of go through those budget development documents. As Chair Carter indicated, on Monday, my colleague Sheila Baker and I will be talking more about these budgets and show you the co-chair's budget and how it hooks in with what's going to be presented today as far as how the governor's budget was developed and then what the co-chair's budget does to that budget. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
In having conversation and listening to what you have been saying, that there was no reference to 0507, there was no GRB associated with the co-chairs, that it was like an abstract document. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was to ask Ms. Baker and Mr. Britton to come and walk us through the budget with those additions so that you can be totally apprised of the difference and what is going on in order for us to go forward as expediently as possible on the work that we have before.
Okay. No question. Before you get there, I don't have a question, but I'd like a point of personal privilege, because
sure.
I would like to, I know you welcome the individuals who are here from the community, but I'd like to do a special welcome, because
sure.
This person has been a friend of mine for over 48 years, and that's Mrs. Stephan, Betty, and I.D. And when we have friendships that last over 40, almost 50 years, and we've been through all the ups and downs and trials and joys together. I just wanted to say welcome to the Capitol, Betty and Steve.
That's great. That's great. Are there any questions of Mr. Britton? Okay. Then let's have Mr. Edge and Company.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. And as Mr. Britton mentioned, we're going to move along quickly today. We have a lot of material to cover. We're going to hit the most important things that are still in the presentation notebook, which is the caseload discussion, the policy option package discussion, and the reductions discussion. Going to do that and hopefully finish in time for a good discussion for the last half hour or so of the budget. So with that, I will just pass it on quickly to Ms. Lynn Reed, our Senior Deputy Administrator.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Reed, Deputy Administrator with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. My initial job here actually is just to introduce Judy Moore Peterson, who will be speaking to the caseload forecasting and how it impacts and is a budget driver for our budget.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the administrator for forecasting research and analysis for the Department of Human Services. As in my position, one of the things that we do is forecast the caseloads for medical assistance programs. And so I was going to talk a little bit about how caseloads are a major driver for medical assistance programs, a little about what that forecast looks like, and then some major risks to the forecast. And Mr. Britton is going to hand out some supplemental materials that will be part of my presentation. They are also on the table over there for our guests. First of all, I don't think it is a surprise, but...
Can you hold for a minute? Thank you. Mm-hmm. I want to react to something you just said. Mm-hmm. So those that are visiting, on the table on my left over here, if you want to keep up with what is going on, you can get a copy of the material that that she will be responding from, or be delivering from. So if you'd like to get up now and go get a copy, you can feel free to do that. Thank you.
Thanks. So first of all, I'd just like to emphasize that caseload, whether it goes up or down, is one of the major drivers for medical assistance programs. It is by no means the only caseload or the only driver. The cost per person, medical expenditures, et cetera, are obviously other major drivers for the OHP budget. The other piece that I would like to just do in one sentence is that historically for the Oregon Health Plan, in the last 2 years, it experienced some very rapid growth in a couple of the major eligibility groups, followed by, in the last year or so, a recent kind of decline or almost straight line. And then followed recently, we are anticipating that it is going to resume kind of a very moderate growth on the basis of the economy, population growth, and just historical trends. Then, I would also like to draw your attention to the effect on the supplemental materials to the graphs. And let's see, the graphs on... They start on the page 3 of 9 in the supplemental materials. That's all the caseloads all together, all the different eligibility groups. If you turn to the next page, on page 4 of 9, that's the temporary assistance for needy families. I'd like to clarify that this is related to the temporary assistance for needy families that receive the cash benefit, but it is a bigger program than that, in that individuals and families who are participating in this program do not necessarily have to receive the cash benefit, and they can receive medical. So it's actually a much larger program. It also contains the transitional benefits, also known as TANF extended. This is a caseload that has experienced a great deal of change and fluctuation over the past 2 years. And we are anticipating that it will continue to have a great deal of change and fluctuation into the future. That is one of the reasons why you see the dotted lines, because those are expected variation. With any forecast, the further out you go, the more you can expect it to vary from what you predict when you finally get there. And in the case of our forecasting for the governor's recommended budget, and now again for the spring 2007, which will be used for the reshoot of the governor's recommended budget. We're using September of 2006 as our last data point to do our estimates, and those estimates go all the way through June of 2009. So one can expect variation just in the normal process of forecasting by the time you get all the way out there. There are some caseloads that have more risk than even what the anticipated or expected risk is. And this is one of them, the temporary assistance for needy families. The reason for that is twofold. In the last year, there have been several major policy changes that were enacted, as well as business changes and how the cases are reviewed. We are still seeing the effects. They're still working their way through the system, and they have not yet stabilized. So while we can try to estimate what those changes and what the effects will be, they still are going forward, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen. The other major reason that this forecast has more risk associated with it than normal is because of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, the TANF reauthorization. That particular program, which I believe this committee has heard about already, will have an impact on the medical side as well. It is still in the process of being redesigned as to what the final structure will look like, and even once it's done, we can still only put forward our best estimate as to what the effects will be, but we don't there's a lot of unknowns and a lot of indeterminates that make it very difficult to forecast what the final effects will be.
One question. Do you find most of the people in this group, is that associated with people who are very sick, who come on the program? Can you give us a little profile?
In the temporary assistance for needy families?
Yeah.
Their profile looks very similar to the temporary assistance for needy families who receive the cash benefit. So they're not sicker or healthier than that particular population. They tend to be families who are very poor and have a lot of challenges facing them, but not necessarily more health challenges than other people of similar federal poverty levels.
Mr. Redden?
Madam Chair, I want to clarify something. In this particular sub-caseload of the Oregon Health Plan, temporary assistance for needy families, many of these people are children, right?
That is correct. About two-thirds of this particular caseload are children, and one-third are adults.
Okay. Further
questions? Thanks. Another caseload that we are anticipating having, or there's a lot of risk associated with it, is the Children's Health Insurance Program, or the CHIP Children's Program, and that is on page 6 of 9 in the supplemental materials. In June of 2006, there were changes made to the certification period. It was extended from 6 months to 12 months before the children needed to come back for recertification. In December is the first point in which you would expect to start to see the difference, because it's with those families who were just coming in and applying, newly applying, or the children who were recertifying that got that extra 6 months of eligibility time. So the first point that you can see that effect is December, which means that that what we've predicted is based entirely upon our best thinking on what we think that impact will be. But we don't have any actual data points to know how close we were to our estimates. So there's a great deal of risk associated with the chip forecast as well. Actually, those are the two main ones with a lot of risk associated with them. So if it's okay with the committee, if there's no further questions, I'll turn this back over to
just one question.
Yes.
How would the numbers increase in the event of the passage of the Healthy Kids program compared to the numbers that are already in the system?
The Healthy Kids policy action package is not included at the present time in these estimates. They are, and we did work very closely with the various program areas to provide estimates on what we thought the impact would be on all the caseloads as far as the impact of Healthy Kids. I believe that Ms. Reed's going to be speaking to that particular policy action package shortly.
Thank you.
And can provide the exact numbers.
Further questions? Thank you. Welcome, Lynn. Good to see you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my job so far seems to be inviting someone else to speak at the table, and I'd like to invite Jeannie Phillips to the table to speak to the very first policy option package. It's on page 67 behind that tab, and that happens to be the Healthy Kids Plan. And Ms. Phillips can respond to your question, I think, as a part of her presentation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. That was good timing on the Healthy Kids. There are seven policy option packages today, and I'll be discussing the first one with you, the Healthy Kids Plan. And so we begin on page 67. And the budget request is for $56.3 million in other funds, which are the tobacco tax funds, and $48.9 million in federal funds, totaling $105.2 million in total funds included in the governor's recommended budget. Most of you are already familiar with the Healthy Kids Plan and the benefits of providing children access to health care, so I'll keep my comments briefly today. All kids and families with incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level, which is about $40,000 a year for a family of four, will be eligible for coverage through the existing programs under the Oregon Health Plan and under the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or FEOP, that's managed by the Office for Private Health Partnerships. These programs are currently available to families with incomes at or below 185% of the federal poverty level. And then families with incomes above 200% will be eligible to buy affordable, comprehensive group coverage for their children and receive subsidies for those premiums if their incomes are below 350% of the federal poverty level. The bill supporting the Healthy Kids Plan was amended to reduce that percentage to 300%, which is about $60,000 a year for a family of four. For the 07-09 biennium, approximately 30,000 children would be added to programs administered by the Department of Human Services and over 15,000 children to programs administered by the Office for Private Health Partnerships.
Question, Senator Winters, could you or Mr. Britton, and you don't need to do it now, provide with the cost at 185%, which we currently are at, and the 200% of poverty, and then the 300% that subsidy, so that we have some idea of what the dollar figures look like?
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, we'll make sure we get that information for you.
Thank you.
The Office for Private Health Partnerships will have responsibility for subsidizing employer-sponsored health insurance, as they do today, developing and administering all health plan carrier contracting for a private insurance product for children, and determining and administering the subsidies for that product. And they'll also enroll children in the private insurance product. Lastly, they'll administer the marketing and outreach component of the Healthy Kids Plan with support from the Department of Human Services. I believe $4 to $5 million has been included in their budget request to fund this component. The Office for Private Health Partnerships will be presenting to this committee next week, is my understanding, and they'll address planning for their portions.
That's right, they will be.
Okay. And they'll address planning for portions of the Healthy Kids Plan, including the outreach component. The Department of Human Services will have responsibility for determining initial and continuing eligibility for all applicants for Healthy Kids, whether they'll be enrolled in programs administered through the Department of Human Services or whether it will be in programs administered through the Office for Private Health Partnerships. We'll also be developing an online application capability and other technology to support the Healthy Kids operations. We'll be expanding access to the disease management program and the nurse advice line, and we'll be submitting and obtaining the necessary federal approvals for the Oregon Health Plan waiver expansions in both the programs in the Department of Human Services and the Office for Private Health Partnerships to secure the federal Medicaid matching funds. The Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research also has a role with the Healthy Kids Plan. They will have responsibility for analyzing and evaluating the plan and producing reports on enrollment, performance, and outcomes. An additional program performance measure was developed for this policy option package, and it's shown for you on page 69, reducing the percentage of uninsured children below 200% of the federal poverty level. In 2004, although over 12% of Oregon's children were uninsured, approximately 18% of children and families with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level were uninsured. It's about 60 to 68,000 children. Data from the 2006 Oregon Population Survey is currently under analysis, and once that analysis is complete, the percentage for 2006 will be reflected on this chart, and the target for the performance measure will be established.
Madam Chair, Senator Letters. Question. Is it your hope that through the information hotline that you're able to reach that population that is already eligible without extending the poverty level upward to reach those children? Is that the intent through the hotline?
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, the hotline is to answer questions and provide a vehicle for people to request applications. But I agree with you, it would be tragic if we raise the maximum income levels to qualify and we didn't place some effort on getting at those kids that are in the lower income brackets.
So what efforts or what strategies are you going to use to get those individuals who are currently qualified and who are not enrolled?
Madam Chair, Senator Renners, there's the funding for marketing and outreach that's included in the budget for the Office of Private Health Partnerships. They're putting their plans together at this time, and they're looking at a number of grants that individuals or groups, organizations can apply for that would help them to do very specific outreach within their communities. And we wanted to make sure that the outreach plan is culturally sensitive and recognizes the needs of communities across the states, and so we could target the outreach in that fashion.
Do you have already demographics of where that population or these populations are so that when you begin your marketing strategy, you're able to say, for example, we know that we have X number of kids that are probably eligible in North Northeast or in Salem, that you're able to do targeting based on the marketing strategies that actually reach those populations?
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, we do have demographic data that tells us where the uninsured children are located. As far as looking at some of the nuances within those communities, that's still work yet to be done. When the Medicaid Advisory Committee held the public hearings across the state in regard to the Healthy Kids Plan, they also held meetings with representatives from different cultural communities and had discussions about what we could do to make sure that we are recognizing the needs of individual communities. So I guess my best answer is to say we've begun that process, but there's a lot of work yet to be done.
Any more staff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 68, you mentioned that children enrolled in the DHS portion of Healthy Kids will be eligible for a variety of the third paragraph. Then it goes on to say we'll incorporate dental sealant for kids as proposed by the Public Health Division. So is that traditionally, is that meant to be part of the Healthy Kids program in terms of the legislation, or is this an add-on? I don't quite understand the department's add-ons to this.
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, it is part of the original plan, of the governor's plan, that we would include the dental sealant program in there. And this will be a program that will be administered out of the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. They currently have a program in place, and this will allow them to expand that program.
Representative Coutet? Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Senator Winter's question. I think it's an excellent one about outreach, and I think one of the strongest things about the Healthy Kids Plan is when the Medicaid Advisory Committee was reviewing with stakeholders how we were actually going to get children on the program, that we have dollars in the budget for outreach. And in addition to the streamlining that's on there, the simpler application, the 12-month eligibility, those things were going to not only get kids on the program but retain them. So one of the questions I had about the 6 to 12-month issue for the poverty level medical, on page 68, you talk about extending the eligibility period from children. We talked about this yesterday from 6 to 12 months. Have you calculated the workload savings? And you mentioned it here. And is that incorporated in the budget? And have you seen any workload savings in the CHIP population because we have gone to 12 months?
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, we did calculate it for the Healthy Kids Plan, and actually it is reflected in the staffing request for the Healthy Kids Plan. One of the things that has made it more complex is it's only cases that are children-only cases where you're actually going to see a workload savings. And so children that are in households that there are adults receiving some type of benefits, you're still going to have those re-evaluations or recertifications attached with whatever schedule the adults in the household are on. So that does further limit the number of cases, and I couldn't tell you what that number is today. But the experiences of states across the nation have been, for the children-only cases, about a 25% reduction in workload when you extend that certification period. As part of the Healthy Kids Planning process, we also looked at a lot of technology to support the Healthy Kids Plan and how could we reduce the administrative cost. And so the online application is one example. Having a document system where applications and whatnot can actually be photocopied and create a record in the system was another aspect of it. Setting up more automated information exchanges between the Office for Private Health Partnerships and the Department of Human Services is another piece. So all of those components combined to greatly reduce the amount of staff to support the Healthy Kids Plan.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just to go back to the outreach issue for a moment, one of the things I'd be interested in getting more information on, if you'll provide it in written form, is how that contracting process is going to roll out. The key to successful outreach is going to rest on how the contracts are written, the process for letting those contracts, how they get monitored, and would like to have some clarity about what that process looks like within the agency, who's responsible for it, where the accountability is if you're not getting the results. And if you could detail that for us, it would be very helpful.
And Madam Chairman and Senator Gordley, we most certainly will do that. One thing I will point out is that the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research will also be charged with evaluating the results of our outreach plan. And we did just have a discussion yesterday about the planning around the grants and the importance of making sure that we have community input before we move forward with finalizing any type of a plan to make sure we're covering all the bases.
That's the piece, frankly, Madam Chair, that I'm most concerned about and most nervous about, because that's where we have failed in the past. But that fact is something to learn from, as opposed to repeating past mistakes.
Senator Rogers, she just brought a thought to me, and that was yesterday, and I believe it was Cecilia Marcet carried the bill. The Senate passed legislation that had to do with giving authorization for going after overpayments or payments that that were made to individuals that really weren't eligible. And what safeguards do you have? Are you planning, or do you have in this electronic application process?
Madam Chairman and Senator Winters, safeguards, I guess I need some clarification for your question.
Well, and more second part, Joe.
Let me tell you what Senator Bridger's objection was and why she voted no on the bill, because she felt that the department should not be sending money directly to the clients who might misuse the money, that they should be sending money to the power company who, you know, is going to turn off the power. And that amounts to a number of millions of dollars, $60 million or whatever. It's a huge amount of money. And so her objection is that she got to know on the collection part of it, which was completely separate from her complaint. And so the question is, how are you going to track whether or not that money sent out is appropriately used?
Madam Chairman and Senator Winters and Senator Morissette, thank you for clarifying that situation. In the medical assistance programs, there are no direct payments. Usually there are no direct payments to clients. And so payments go directly to the provider, so you won't have an instance, as you've described. But there are instances that an individual would be determined eligible for a program, and maybe later information would come to light that reveals that they never should have gotten medical assistance benefits. Each one of those are looked at on their own merits to see what was the cause of the overpayment. And so a family could be charged with an overpayment, for example, if they fraudulently obtained medical coverage and we subsequently paid providers for medical care that they had received.
Therein lies the question, what do you do when that happens? And how aggressive are your strategies for doing that?
Madam Chair, to tell you the truth, I don't know the answer to that question, because I don't work with that section of the department, but okay. I will make sure that we get the information for you.
Okay. Madam Chair, maybe Lynn can answer the question, because a follow-up piece of which you don't make payments direct to the individual, but to the providers. And I have a request from an individual for legislation that would require that the agency sends it to the provider, because they had difficulty where payments had gone to an individual and the individual then did not pay the provider. So I guess I need to talk to the agency aside and clarify that, because I'm sitting with our former Senate president who contacted me for a bill. So then maybe we need to have a conversation later.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I'll be glad to have that conversation and get some more specifics and see if we can get the answer to what
whether it's happening. Not the doctor, but where it could be like an MRI, or where you have other kinds of medical services and that the individual was paid rather than the service was paid.
Generally, that I would not expect that to happen in terms of our payments. Perhaps another third-party payer is involved as well.
Thank you. I need to move you a little fast, because we have about 22 minutes.
Madam Chair, that does conclude my remarks, and so if there are no further questions, I'll return the floor.
Okay, thank you. But Jim, while the next person is coming, be prepared to answer the question in terms of, in the co-chair's budget, we zeroed out dental sealants. And so what do you plan to do in terms of having that relationship with the Department of Public Health?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, directing your attention to page 69, the next policy package is Cawam Prenatal Care. That's our citizen alien waived emergency medical program, which is mandated by federal government in order to operate a Medicaid program. It currently provides emergency services and labor and delivery services to individuals who would qualify for our programs except by virtue of their citizenship. So they have a very limited benefit package. 85% to 95% of the expenditures in this program, however, are for labor and delivery. So it's primarily serving that population of pregnant women whose babies then, of course, are U.S. citizens upon birth. This package would look at beginning a process of providing prenatal care to those pregnant women, a full wraparound benefit package during pregnancy. Federal regulations do allow states to do that with an enhanced reimbursement, recognizing the value that prenatal care provides in terms of the health of the mother and the health of the child. We would propose that the $4.5 million other funds that are listed here, it's a limitation, and it's a placeholder for local government matching monies to pay for the net cost of providing this new benefit in pilot locales. Right now, we have, I might say that this represents about 60% of the money that would be needed to go statewide. And in the governor's recommended budget, or a reshoot of the governor's recommended budget, we may address that funding limitation to allow for more.
What are the pilot locations?
The pilot location so far is one. One county has agreed to participate in that program, and it's Multnomah County. And about just a little under 25% of the births for this population are in Multnomah County. So it would pick up about a fourth of the pregnant women in the Cawam program. If we receive policy direction from the legislature to move forward with this and limitation, then in the future, as other counties are able and willing to put up funds, we could add additional counties to the program. It does require federal approvals through a state plan amendment, so we'd go through that process in order to add additional counties in the future. The policy options are the performance measure that accompanies this policy package is on page 70. And what we're doing here is looking at the column clients who initiate prenatal care that's paid by our division in the first 4 months of pregnancy. It's a rather modest target of 50% in 2008, the first year of the program. We anticipate this program would start in January 2008, increasing to 60% in 2009. We'll need a little bit of experience to see how successful we can be in reaching out to this population and getting people enrolled and accessing care early in their pregnancy.
Just for a moment, Representative Cote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lynn, I just have a question. Do we know what percentage of CAWA mothers currently have prenatal care? This is one of the smartest things we can do. I mean, we're paying for the delivery. We should try to get them prenatal care, but do we know what that number is?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we do not have that number directly, but I'll check in with the Public Health Division to see if there's anything that they have that would be helpful to us in looking at a baseline that is not one that we pay for, but that someone else may be paying for, including the client or the individual herself.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morissette.
2 days ago we had a discussion about the variation of the program where Oregon, there's a delay process where the state of California and other states do it more up front and cover more mothers, and I forget the
presumptive,
the presumptive care. Yeah, so we're not doing presumptive care.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said that's correct. We do not provide presumptive eligibility for a program. You need to go through an eligibility determination process.
And that delays the coverage.
Yes, it can.
And it can preclude people, perhaps.
That also...
And we did talk about the difference in cost. Okay, I just wanted to...
Yeah, we don't have the dollars.
Right.
We will.
Okay, I'm gathering that information.
I have a management problem. I have 10 minutes.
Okay.
And we got to go through page 178. Okay. So,
in other words, all right. Okay. On page 70, the next policy package is increasing fee for service reimbursement for certain provider groups that is targeted at physician services and some other providers that are reimbursed on a similar methodology. It also includes providers of radiology, laboratory, physical and occupational therapy, and speech and audiology. And currently, our payment rates are fairly low. They represent about 68% of what Medicare would pay for those services to physicians. This package would raise that payment rate in our fee-for-service program to 75% of what Medicare pays.
Representative Cotet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your indulgence. We heard from several folks yesterday in public testimony about their rates not being where they should be, and they're not on this list necessarily. How is this list of rates decided, and can we get the information to find out on the various types of Medicaid services, how much would it cost to get the various types of providers to the rates that would be appropriate, whether it's home care or ambulatory or if you have that handy.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, rather than respond directly to the question right now, we'll include that in the responses that we bring back in writing, if that's satisfactory.
That's great. Thank you.
I would just point on page 71 with the performance measure that the percentages that are listed here should be struck, and we're in the process of revising those. I expect by mid-April to have new numbers. We discovered some problem with these numbers as we're relooking at the 2004 survey results and the new 2006 survey results. Our intent is to at least maintain the current level of participation of physicians in the Medicaid program as we have today, and perhaps increase it slightly with the modest fee increase that we propose. Moving on to page 72 in the next policy option package, which is extending the sunset on provider taxes that are used in the Oregon Health Plan. These are provider taxes on Medicaid managed care plans and hospitals. Currently, they're set to sunset January 1, 2008. The bills that support this package would have the sunsets extended to October 1, 2009. That would generate $191 million in revenue that would support the OHP standard population, 24,000 individuals. The policy option package that, or the performance measure on page 73 that accompanies this, is really going to be determined in tandem with a later policy option package that would add 10,000 standard. We think together the two packages would serve 34,000 clients and could make a measurable difference in terms of the number of uninsured individuals with income below 100% of the poverty level. I would now like to turn to Dr. Schaefer to talk about the policy option package that begins at the bottom of page 73 related to our planned drug list.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Walter Schaefer, Medical Director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. This policy option package contains two provisions related to the Oregon Health Plan drug list. The first is inclusion of mental health drugs. When the practitioner-managed prescription drug plan was created in 2001, drugs used to treat mental health conditions were excluded, but that provision sunsetted on January 1st of this year. So currently, mental health drugs can be added to the plan drug list. This is a large part of the fee-for-service pharmacy budget, in part because of the carve-out of mental health drugs from the managed care organizations. So the mental health drugs amount to 55% of our pharmacy budget. The other provision in this policy option is a new prior authorization authority for all classes of drugs in the plan drug list. Prior authorization does not prevent the prescribing of a non-listed drug, but it adds a step, a phone call to our from the prescriber to our pharmacy management program to authorize a non-listed drug. And the primary criteria for granting a exception will be that it's being used for treatment of a diagnosis that's above the funding line on the prioritized list. The
Madam Chair? Oh, Senator Gordon?
Thank you. I'd like to probe a bit here, and what I want to know is going to take more time than we have left in our conversation today, so I'm going to ask some questions that will require your follow-up. I really want to understand how this is going to work, and I want to better understand the assumptions behind the thinking and how this is going to work. I understand what we're saying about it adding, that the policy is one that would add an additional step, and that there's a criteria for making exceptions. But I want to know more about the criteria, how the criteria are set, the judgment involved in making decisions, and what values are put into play when someone is making a decision about exceptions. I'm uncomfortable with where we are, and I'm thinking about that consumer out there who may need a certain type of medication now and may be subject to some set of criteria and decision making on somebody's part about whether or not they're going to get the type of medication they need when they need it.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, part of my I agree that the these questions need a complete discussion, and part of my answer will be that this policy option package has a legislative life in the form of Senate Bill 160, and that bill has been amended and passed through Senator Morissette's Senate Committee on Health Policy, and it's been referred to the Ways and Means Committee, which presumably means that this subcommittee will be beginning deliberations on that bill, and will have an opportunity at that time to have public testimony and so on. And I will say that the bill that you will receive has been amended to exclude antipsychotic medications from the prior authorization system. Otherwise, we can provide more detailed information about how the system will work in written form for
Madam Chair, we would, and Senator Gordley, we would be glad to come and meet with you personally and talk through some of those issues too.
And the information that I want is the step-by-step decision-making process that will be involved in implementing the criteria. Who makes the decisions, and at what point, and based on what information, and with, that's what I'm after. Is that clear?
Madam Chair, I share the same concerns. So, I mean, and I don't know how many other members share the concerns. And so I, too, would like to be walked through.
Senator Carter and Senators Gordley and Winters, we would be glad to do that on a on an individual basis or however we want to arrange it. Some of the, I think the concerns are appropriate in that cost savings and cost containment are appropriate goal of ours, but if you just have cost savings without assuring quality of care and without assuring the safety of the Oregon Health Plan clients, then it can actually be detrimental. So we have a system that I can describe to you when we have time that assures quality and safety for the Oregon Health Plan clients.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
just take a deep breath.
Madam Chair,
three more pages.
I just want to add one thought.
Okay, Senator Morissette, and then
evidence-based medicine will come into play. Evidence-based, the safest kind. Evidence-based.
But Senator Morissette,
don't go there.
I don't know why you guys want to get me started. Come on, Senator
Morissette. I just have a suggestion, because we heard 2 days ago about some of the other savings around prescription drugs that the department's proposing. Right. If we could hear all of these together, 160, and some of the other things, because yesterday we heard testimony about the wholesale price versus the... There's some issues around prescription drugs in general, and we're counting on those savings to balance the budget. So it would be nice to do them all together to some degree if we can. Thank you.
Mr. Bittner?
Madam Chair and Representative Kojak, on page 78, which we're rapidly trying to get to, there is a discussion, or not a discussion, but at least a listing of a number of those.
Okay, Ms. Reed, go for it. Dr. Schaefer.
Unless we need further discussion, I will just say that this policy option package does save money in two ways. More less costly drugs are prescribed, and the state receives more supplemental rebates from the drug manufacturers when we have a planned drug list that can be enforced through prior authorization, and those are detailed in the summary.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I'll step in here quickly. At the bottom of page 75 is the next policy option package, which would expand the OHP standard program by approximately 10,000 clients. It would be funded with new tobacco tax revenue in the governor's recommended budget, $52.5 million. And I've already talked about the implications along with the continuation of this provider taxes in terms of being able to serve 34,000 OHP standard clients from a former population of over 100,000 clients. The last policy package is on page 77, package 108, hospital payment rates. This impacts payments made to what are called DRG hospitals. These are hospitals of 50 beds or over 50 beds that are paid on a diagnosis-related grouping. And we have wide variation in what are called the base rates paid to these hospitals in terms of how their base payment prior to the advent of provider taxes compared to Medicare payments. And it ranged from 47.4% of Medicare to 70.8% of Medicare. And it just depended upon which hospital you were. This policy package would bring up that base rate with $5 million in new tobacco tax along with federal matching funds that would need to get fixed in the reshoot of the governor's budget to add those limitation for those funds. And it would bring up, it's estimated, 8 hospitals and establish a new floor for base payments of 59.4% of Medicare.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you. There is a bill here in the legislature that alleges that the metropolitan hospitals are being shortchanged from that pool of available dollars by the rural hospitals who are charging a higher rate than the metropolitan hospitals. Is that accusation correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, I can't answer that directly. In statute, in Oregon statute, rural hospitals, what are called type A and B hospitals and critical access hospitals, which are small hospitals, not necessarily exactly rural, but they're small hospitals, 50 beds or under, they are entitled to cost-based reimbursement, whereas the larger hospitals do not have that same guarantee in statute, and that may be
the particular issue.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Nicholson?
I don't understand the economics of this or the rules very well. You have told us that with this policy option package, we're going to bring, some people are paid here, some are paid here, and we're going to bring the lowest ones up. What's going to prevent the condition from just getting unequal again?
I did a very shortcut on my explanation of this policy option package. I talked about what are base rates, and these are the portion of the rates paid to hospitals that are funded currently with general funds and federal funds. On top of that, because of provider taxes, we have an enhanced payment rate, and we use hospital provider tax revenue for the enhanced payment, and that enhanced payment actually is at 100% of the 2004 Medicare rate. So all of those hospitals are being paid in enhanced payment, but part, it's the portion of their payment that's supported by state funds versus their own provider tax funds. And what they're seeking is equity in the state funds that are coming into the individual hospitals. And they want to see more state dollars in that mix of payments. And I'd be glad to go over it in greater detail with you one-on-one, where I think I can add some clarity to that.
Thank you. And the general fund is not available, and that's causing the problem.
Ms. Reed? All right. The last piece that I'd like to touch on is page 78. These are the reductions that are in the governor's recommended budget that are changes from how our program operates today. The first two packages that are listed here are ones that, for the most part, Alice Labansky covered when she talked about the pharmacy efficiencies and the changes in reimbursement. And this shows the savings that we will realize from those activities.
Sure.
The third one, 90-10, is a reduction in the maximum amount that we would pay to durable medical equipment and medical supply for equipment and medical supplies. Currently, our reimbursement is about 100% of the Medicare rate, and this would change our maximum reimbursement to 80% of the Medicare rate. The next one is for those DRG hospitals.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. Lynn, have you had conversation with the stakeholder group, and like we did before in the past, so that they were part of this reduction discussion?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I don't believe they were a part of the discussion that led to this option here. The next one is related to 90-12, is related to payments that are in the capitation rates for managed care plans that go to the DRG hospitals. The governor's recommended budget has the capitations rates built on 90% of cost for these hospitals, and that generates a savings of $21.5 million general fund. I believe the co-chairs have a further reduction to that. The next item is the COWM program, not the COWM prenatal package, but the base COWM program. And the governor's budget does a backfill of general fund with new tobacco tax and funds that program with new tobacco tax, $22.1 million rather than general fund. Then the next item is a policy package within the Division of Medical Assistance Public Health Division for their Family Planning Expansion Program. And basically, this is a shift of money from our budget, $920,000, over to their budget to expand that program and target outreach for family planning. And the expectation is that will generate a savings in our program as fewer women our caseload is reduced by fewer women who have unplanned pregnancies. And the last two are technical in nature.
Questions? Representative Cortez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lynn, about option 90-12 on managed care rates, what are the policy choices being made here? Why the reduction? What is it? Other than, is it a budgetary issue, or is this what's the policy issue driving the proposed reduction? Is there one?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, that is a difficult question for me to answer. Our agency request budget was built on 100% of cost. It was 100% of cost from the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan up until the 2003 legislative session. At that time, there was a shortfall in funding. The industry stepped up, the hospitals, the managed care plans, and they said, we're willing to provide these services at 72% of what the actuary says would be cost. And they did so. In 2005, the legislature made the decision that they wanted to continue payment at 72% of cost, and that's what it is today. And we'll continue it like that until December of this year. The 90% is a gain from today, but it doesn't go all the way. I mean, that's about all I have to offer, unless Eric would like to add to it.
No. So from that, I would take it as it's primarily budget versus. I'm just wondering what the impacts of service delivery are when you do this, and has that been reviewed, and is that a factor when you consider 90, 85, 95? I'm just wondering if that's discussed.
It was not a discussion point. It was more what the market would bear that would still recognize we need adequate reimbursement in the system in order to ensure access. But we have many providers that are not getting full reimbursement.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not a question. It's a comment that was stimulated by Representative Kotek's questions. It is important for us to pay attention to the policy implications of what would be cut or what wouldn't be gained. It's also important to me to pay attention to what was just mentioned, which is if we can't afford to fund everything, do we fund a few things at 100% of what was requested and keep other things at a very depressed level, or do we try to achieve some gains in an equitable way across the board? And I think that is, in a way, by itself, a policy decision. It's not based on service, but it's based on equity in programs and attention to people's needs across the board in many different areas. And then, indeed, that it's a type of a budget policy rather than a program policy.
Thank you very, very much. Mr. Swanson, will you join us?
Good afternoon, Chair Carter and committee members. For the record, my name is John Swanson, Administrator of the Finance and Policy Section of the Department of Human Services. Appreciate the opportunity to walk the committee through a summary of the governor's budget and how it was built for each of the health services divisions that you've heard. We started a few weeks ago, mentioned that we would be putting a budget build addendum in each of the notebooks that you've looked at, and that's what this is referring to. I don't, many of you have probably looked through that. You'll note that in the Addenda 1 sections, the first page or two is a summary display of this budget bill, and that's what is being handed out to you right now. And then I wanted to point out, though, that in those addendum behind that summary is a more detailed listing of the elements of these packages that comprise the governor's budget. I'm going to try to only touch on some of the larger general fund items in the packages that appear in the summary so we can get through the overview today. And I would ask that if you have questions of the specific package elements, we would be glad to meet with you to answer those or to break those down so that we can get through this presentation. I'm going to start with the Division of Medical Assistance Plan, since we just heard the overview of that budget. And as you can see at the top of the page, on page...
One of 11.
Mm-hmm. We start with the base budget, and basically, it's already at that page, one of eight.
It should have a Division of Medical Assistance Plans at the top. The base budget, the first line at the top, is basically the authority, the general fund authority and limitation as of the April 2006 special session for the Department or the Division of Medical Assistance Plans, the general fund, other fund, federal funds. And that is the base. We don't do a line item zero-based budget. We do a what's called a central budget level budget, and that becomes the base for development of the 2009-709 biennial budget. To that base, the department develops a series of packages that adjust the base to what's called the essential budget level, thus the term essential packages. And basically what that means is what we're trying to do is to take the current array of services and programs as of April 06, our base budget, and adjust the cost to continue to provide those services and programs into the 07-09 budget, our biennium. So we're basically taking that base and adjusting it to do what we're doing at that point in time for different kinds of changes in the cost. As I said, the packages that adjust that are called the essential packages, which is the next section on this page. In the DMAP budget, the essential packages you'll see there, the first one is open up for personal service adjustment. Is that basically is a adjustment in the anticipated or projected position vacancy savings or changes in that or pension bond contributions. The next line is package 021 phase-ins, and phase-in package basically adjusts the budget needs to a full 24 months in 2007-09 for any item that started or any reduction that might have started midway through this biennium or partway through this biennium. For instance, if something started after 6 months, started maybe on the seventh month of this biennium, the base would contain 18 months of funding for that program or service. If that's going to continue into the next biennium, we would need to add an additional 6 months of funding to get it to the full 24 months. That's the phase-in. In DMAP's situation, however, they actually have a reduction or a decline in the budget in phase-ins because we are phasing in additional savings from a couple of items. First of all, we started the Medicaid Modernization Act drug savings during this biennium. It started in January 2006 and will continue then into all of the next 2007-09 biennium. So we will actually experience more savings from the for that Medicaid Drug Act savings in having a full 24 months of that versus only a portion of it in this biennium. And that actually generates an additional reduction or savings of $51 million general fund, dollars of general fund. Offsetting a portion of this savings is a phase-in of the additional cost of the Medicaid Part D state phase-down contribution, the clawback which we talked about, and the added cost for a full biennium in 2009 versus only part of the biennium this year is an increase, a phase-in of additional $42.2 million in general fund. There are also some phase-in savings actions that were started during this biennium that, again, will continue in all of the next biennium that will reduce the budget by another $4.6 million in general fund. Basically, all of these together result in a net general fund savings as a result of these phase-in reductions options or reduction actions. Phase-out package is the opposite of the phase-ins, basically where something that was intended to be one time in this biennium or something that occurred was removed or restored partway through this biennium is removed, we basically phase out the cost for that for the full biennium in 2007-09. So basically it is if something was removed partway through this biennium and the current biennium will be removed all of the next biennium, the roll-up savings or cost is considered this phase-out package. The larger phase-out item in DMAP, again, is kind of backwards because it actually results in a net reduction of the general fund budget, DMAP general fund budget, and it is the phase-out of the reduction
we've been talking about a little bit here of the DRG hospital payments. There was a change in the reimbursement rate from 100% to 72% for this biennium, but it was considered to be a one-time reduction. And so we're phasing out that one-time reduction, which basically moves it back to 100% in the base budget. And we'll be talking in a minute about an adjustment that then moved it back down to 90%. So basically, phasing out this one-time reduction and returning it to the 100% payment level increases the DMAP funeral fund need by $43.6 million. That's what the larger phase-out package. The next item on the list is inflation, and this is one of the larger packages, as you can see, in DMAP. It is also one of the largest packages in the department. And as far as dollar value in general fund, $121.7 million. There's basically three different types of inflation that is used in this budget. The first one is a base inflation, which is the general DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, rule around inflation, adjust the base inflation by 3.1%. And then qualified medical-related items are allowed to have an additional 2.3% for a total of 5.4% inflation on those items. From there, in DMAP, there can be exception inflations after that that are individually reviewed by DAS. And in the case of Department of Medical Assistance Plans, we have an exception in the inflation rate to incorporate the actuary-determined per capita rates that are determined by our actuary. This 030 package takes all three of those pieces of inflation and combines them. And as you can see, it results in about a $121.7 million general fund increase, which is about 43% of the total general fund increase from the base budget to the GRB for this division for DMAP. The other large essential package, as you can see there, is mandated caseloads. And I have a handout I believe John has there that I would like to distribute. This is another prescribed area in the budget development instructions from DAS. And as you can see, there are specific types of caseloads that have been determined to be mandated. And so we're given pretty strict guidelines as to what can be included in that in this package. As you can see, included in there are the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid programs, which is basically all of the DMAP programs. So therefore, they are all considered mandatory on this list. And this package reflects the cost of the change in the DMAP program caseloads at the 2007-09 rates, at the new actuary-determined rates. So it's basically looking at our caseload projections for this biennium as of the base budget, and then looking at the projections out, as Judy had walked you through some of the discussions on how we go about that, looking at those caseloads out into 2007-09, taking the difference between those caseloads and pricing them at the new rates. So between the package 30 for inflations and the package 40 for mandated caseloads, the budget then has incorporated in it the latest caseload program caseloads and the latest per capita costs that we're bringing into the governor's recommended budget. The next package is a fairly sizable package, too, a 050 fund shift. And there are two, this is basically a package that is used to adjust for any known changes in the funding mix of the budget in terms of general fund, other fund, or federal fund. And as you can see, the largest, or one of the largest items in this package is the backfill of the loss of tobacco settlement revenue of about $24.5 million with general fund. Because this tobacco settlement revenue had funded a mandated program, we're requesting a backfill of general fund as a package 050. The other large piece of this adjustment is for tobacco tax revenues, and that's about $107.6 million of this package. And I want to just point out something here. This is not necessarily an issue where tobacco taxes are anticipated to decline, but in the building of the 030 inflation package and the 040 mandated caseload packages, the mechanics of the budget are such that you go ahead and build those packages assuming the current mix of general, other, and federal funds, which is what we've done. We've gone ahead and put in that we would receive other funds, in this case tobacco taxes, for inflationary increases and mandated caseload increases. But in fact, tobacco tax revenues will not increase enough to cover that increase projected from inflation and mandated caseload. So this is a mechanics thing where basically we can come behind that and say, we don't have enough tobacco tax to fund these mandated caseloads and inflation, so we would like a fund shift to backfill that with general fund. So actually, you could look at this in terms of this tobacco tax fund shift of $107 million, the mandated caseloads of 58.4 and the inflation of 121.7 are basically all related, and they comprise virtually the increase in the general fund request in DMAP's budget between the base budget and the governor's recommended budget. Package 060 are technical adjustments, and those generally are just realignment of dollars within budget structures or any other kinds of adjustments that don't fit in any other package. That basically brings us down to the essential budget level, which I mentioned earlier. Again, the cost of continuing to do what we were doing at the base into the next biennium. From there, adjustments related to issues raised at the December e-board. We did the base budget in April 06. We then did another rebalance in December 06 at the e-board. And so any adjustments or items that came to our knowledge between April and December were taken into account in that rebalance. And each of those items were scrutinized in terms of which ones would continue into the next biennium. So if any of those issues had an impact in the next biennium, this would include the roll-up cost of that those issues in that into the governor's recommended budget. That's the package 084, December e-board. The next item there you can see is package 90, and those are analyst adjustments, and those are the ones that Lynn Reed worked through a little bit. They were the last thing we looked at in her presentation. Again, the larger pieces there were an adjustment to move the DRG hospital rates from the 100% that we restored in the phase-in back to 90%, and then the fund shift of the Calum program between tobacco tax and general fund. That basically takes us down to the policy packages that adjust the budget to arrive at the governor's recommended budget that we presented. And you've heard a fairly quick overview of the DMAP policy packages in Lynn Reed's presentation. I would point out that in these addendums, the amounts that appear in each of these divisional bills is only the portion of those the policy packages that affect this division. Most all of our packages go across the bounds of all the divisions in the department, so you'll see a portion of each of these packages in multiple places in this addendum, or in these addendum presentations.
Members, I just wanted to point out it doesn't appear that we're going to be able to make it through addictions and mental health division and public health. We may get through some of it, but the addenda in the back of each notebook that you've been given for health services has all the detail that Mr. Swanson has just been discussing, and labels or shows how each of the phase in, the phase out, the inflation components were built. So it gives you that detail. What I asked John to do today was to go kind of high level over each of these divisions, because certainly for the other two, we didn't get this opportunity. So there's more detail in each of these notebooks if you want to look at it, but this is to give you kind of a lay of the land as far as health services is concerned.
Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question either for the presenter or for the analyst. As a policymaker, one thing that's important to me is to understand what the total is for what it would cost to keep doing what we're doing, and then what's the total of the nice to have if you can afford it to add on. And it looks like
I could easily add it with a calculator for all these different programs if I wanted to do it myself. But does the analyst or someone else have, after understanding the base budget plus the essential packages and adjustments, all the things you need to do to just keep doing what you've been doing? It really takes three groupings there: base budget plus essential packages plus adjustments. Is there a place where we see that total before you add in the policy packages, which are the add-on? I don't see that.
Madam Chair and Representative Nathanson, that could easily be put into this display. I would agree with most of what you said as far as your understanding. This does include the base budget, the essential packages, arguably package 90, the analyst adjustments you could do without. But 084 is pretty essential in the sense that it takes what was done in the rebalance and rolls those forward. They could have been, had anybody had that foreknowledge included in phase-ins or phase-outs, you know. So arguably 084 is kind of an essential sort of a package. The idea, and it can be summed, we can put that total here very easily. In the past, that benchmark was always almost held sacred, I guess. That's kind of my term of art. It was known as current service level or current law level. There have been disputes and many angry words thrown about as far as the right terminology. Most lately, it's been called essential budget level. But the idea behind it is exactly what you said, and that is to say, if we wanted to do what we're doing today and just continue it on into 07-09, what's it going to cost? And that's what that essential package level is, or essential budget level is considered to be.
And brief follow-up,
you may.
And that's what we don't even have a number for, because the only place where we get a total number is, what are we doing today? And then if we could afford to add all these extra things, what it would cost. We don't actually have the total, I don't think. I can't find it. Just what would it cost to continue what we're doing today?
And Madam Chair and Representative Nathanson, in the spreadsheets that Sheila Baker and I have prepared for Monday, it does have a total for the essential package level.
Thank you. I look forward to Monday.
Yeah. And it is essentially the base budget plus the essential packages. Again, some dispute maybe about 084, but I guess I would argue that it could be considered an essential package in some respects.
Thank you.
Representative Perrott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for John, actually. The numbers, John, are these coming from the co-chairs, or are these governor's recommended budget? How close are they? Are they similar at all, et cetera?
Madam Chair and Representative Garrard, we're going to visit that question on Monday extensively. But suffice it to say that what this is the governor's recommended budget. The totals at the bottom, or actually if you flip over onto the top of page 2 of 8, governor's recommended budget is right there as far as the division of medical assistance programs. What Ms. Baker and I intend to do on Monday is to go further and to show you what the co-chairs, how the co-chairs changed that, or if they changed it. Some of these packages were included in the co-chairs budget. Some of them were not included. So we'll show you that on Monday.
Follow that, Chair.
Absolutely. It's
just been my brief experience in my other two Ways and Means committees that the governor's recommended budget is not being followed very closely. So that's why I'm wondering perhaps why we're so focused on this budget when it really not, isn't going to be the final set of numbers that this committee is going to be asked to move forward.
Hence the Monday meeting.
Yeah. I shall.
Await the Monday meeting.
Await
not
Monday.
Sleep all weekend.
Yes, what's we look forward to?
Thank you. I look forward to the Monday meeting as well. And Madam Chair, thank you very much for the way that you have attended to the needs of your committee and helping to move us all forward. having the numbers, the competing set of numbers is one thing, but understanding the assumptions behind the numbers, particularly the co-chair's numbers, is what I'm going to be seeking. That's, you know, that's the crux of it, you know, as far as I'm concerned. If we don't understand the context within which they were thinking and making their judgments, informed by their values, then we're going to miss something. And I don't want to miss something. I want us to have the full meal deal discussion. And I think that that's what... I think that's what the chair wants us to have as well. So I just say that for the good of the order as well.
But one thing that's going to happen, I have listened very careful to your questions and your comments. And when I went to John and Ms. Baker and I said, we can't go any further. I hear my committee asking about this, 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 and this. And you know how I think about success. For any bill to come through this committee that people have heartburn with, and with us taking it to the floor, it causes me heartburn too. I know your hearts and your minds in terms of how you care about the most vulnerable people in our society. So I try to listen to that. So when we get ready to take these to the floor, my committee is not stressed about supporting these bills. And so I said, John said, well, we got to move. I said, John, we can't go anywhere. We just got to stop it. We got to stop in the middle, and you and Ms. Baker are going to have to go down front, and we're going to have an hour and a half discussion on the co-chair's budget, because that's what I heard you say. And in doing so, now you know I'm going to hit you up hard when it comes down for the bill to be passed. I can't help you if you're not here. You've got to be here, because when these bills come, there's nothing I hate worse than a Ways and Means person saying no on the floor to a bill. I just think that that's an absolute royal insult. So I want to make sure that you understand, and if you decide at this level you are no, I can understand that. I can deal with no, but not for the bill to go out and there's no clarification. That does bother me. I am a loyal person to a fault on a Ways and Means Committee, and I'm from the old school in terms of the support of legislation that goes to the floor. And for a Ways and Means person to get up there and trash the bill and vote no, it gives me a heart attack, and I don't do heart attacks to this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I echo the thank you for meeting our needs. We're a rather demanding lot, so I appreciate that. On Monday, John, are we going to see programmatic level numbers on central budget and government? Here's my issue: is that the department is, since reorg, there's a lot of movement. A lot of the vision budgets are very big. It's really hard to get a sense of programmatically where we might see some places that we could move some things around.
Before John answers that, then week after next, I have a meeting set with all of you. My staff is calling your offices now. Dr. Goldberg and I are coming to each of your offices to discuss the programmatic pieces in case you have some heartburn about something. Now, please know this. We have a finite amount of dollars. Adding and subtracting is going to be a problem. But if something needs to be tweaked, I want to listen to that. I want to hear you well on that. But we cannot add dollars that we don't have. And so that would be the only problem that I would have if, let's say, that we're at 250% of poverty level for TANF, and you said, I want 300. I have to say, we don't have the dollars. But if there's something you want tweaked in terms of the bill itself, and we can come to grips with that, I'm more than willing as your chair to listen to that. Does that make sense? That's kind of where we are.
Madam Chair, it certainly makes sense to me, and I'll just serve notice that I'll be using my remaining airtime, some of my remaining airtime between now and signee die, to talk about the need for revenue reform, tax reform. so that we are talking in realistic terms about 21st century Oregon needs and the need for an increased revenue stream that takes care of the needs of Oregon citizens in the human services realm, in the educational realm, and in all the other realms that are about growing a healthy and prosperous Oregon. I don't see how we can have any conversation down here, frankly, without also addressing the other need. And I'm going to use my airtime to keep raising that, and perhaps to the angst of some, but I feel called to do that, and my constituents expect me to do that.
Representative Sotet?
Monday.
Did you want John to come in and answer your question?
As much as you can give on Monday, the happier I'll be.
Okay. Any further questions? Well, Mr. Sonson?
Well, I talked as fast as I could, but didn't put through it anyway.
You did a good job.
If there are, again, the rest of the information is in the same order, the same explanation in terms of the needs for those programs, and if there are any questions, I would be more than glad to...
Stay tuned, because you might be called back.
I probably will.
John, anything before any parting remarks? Thank you very much.
Thank you.